from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Laura Pritchett is an award-winning author and conservationist whose work is rooted in the American West, particularly the mountains of Colorado. She is the author of the novels Stars Go Blue, Sky Bridge, and Hell's Bottom, Colorado, which was the winner of the Milkweed National Fiction Prize and the Penn USA Award.
Her nonfiction work covers stories about bears, wolves, rivers, fossil fuels, and dumpster diving. Laura Pritchett joins us in the first half of the show to discuss her work, her inspiration, and her hopes of rewilding nature as well as ourselves.
And in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Zach Frankel. He is the executive director of Utah Rivers Council. The URC is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the conservation and stewardship of Utah's rivers and surrounding ecosystems.
Last month, the URC joined forces with a number of other environmental groups across the Colorado watershed to form the Colorado River Connection, an alliance designed to expand awareness and activism regarding the myriad of proposed uses of both the Colorado and Green River basins, particularly by the fossil fuel industry.
Right, all that, and if we have time, some news on our latest weather records. There's quite a few, and a proposal from the governor last week to ban the use of wood-burning fireplaces from November to March. How will that impact us here in Summit County?
You can join in on the conversation today with both of our guests by posting to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney.
Join us for The Mountain Life Wednesday at 9 a.m. From narcissism to the social instinct of trust.
From training like an Olympian to rowing across oceans.
From racing the Tour of Utah to cruising the Round Valley Trails. It's all on The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Wednesday at 9 a.m. Brought to you by
Park City Bonanza Instacare, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design,
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage services provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more, currently nearly 6 million pounds per year. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. And on the phone with us is author Laura Pritchett. She's both an award-winning author and a conservationist whose work is rooted in the American West. And she's published over 100 essays and short stories in numerous magazines, including Orion and High Country News. Mm. So, Laura, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your background and how you came to be a writer about the American West?
Well, I'm a Colorado native, and I grew up on a small ranch in northern Colorado. And I had all the usual animals of, cattle and horses and donkeys, but we also had peacocks and raccoons and so on. But I also had six brothers, which I always joke forced me to go outside and be alone a lot. So
wow.
I was either hiking or reading, and thus my two great loves of my life, being outside and reading and writing books, was born in an effort to just escape chores and escape my brothers.
How'd that, and did that work?
I think it worked pretty well.
Great. Well, you know, we've looked at your really broad array of work, and we want to start by talking about one of your recent articles that's, of course, based on an issue in Colorado, and talks about the recent flooding in Colorado and how that impacted some of the fracking sites there. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I live at the foothills of Colorado near northwest of Fort Collins, and Near me is Weld County, and Weld County is the epicenter of fracking, not only for Colorado, but in all of America. Weld County has 20,000 active oil and gas wells, during the flooding, which last year in 2013, the floods here were horrible, but they were made even worse because the year previous there had been huge wildfires, and so all the grass and trees that would have held the water were, of course, burned, and the water washed, and the rivers were very silty and ash-filled and clogged up everything, which caused further flooding out into fields. And so at the time, I had been interviewing a gentleman named Shane Davis, who coined the term fractivist and has been one of the great leaders of fighting fracking in Colorado. I had been interviewing him, and he said, hey, come on, get on a flight sponsored by EcoFlight, which is a wonderful organization based out of Aspen, run by Bruce Gordon, who was friends with John Denver, and perhaps you've had him on, but it's a wonderful organization where they use planes to fly reporters and politicians and others above sites that are hard to see from the ground. You know, right. You just can't see the fracking spills from the ground. And so I jumped on the plane with a CNN crew, and we flew above, so I could witness it myself, flew above horrendous flooding and very obvious oil and gas spills. I think around 2,000 oil and gas wells were shut down during that flooding, and dozens did spill. And you could just see it flowing into the water. You could see orange and green-looking, mostly orange chemicals.
Right.
And this is water that's then flowing into not only the rivers, but I guess people's yards probably and ranches.
Or reservoirs or so. Drinking water sources.
All of the above, yes. This was the South Platte I was flying above, but sure, there's all the tributaries, and that water is, of course, used by many people, both in farming in Weld County and east, and in reservoir drinking water, yes.
Well, that's one big change you've seen, I guess, over the years. You, like you say, you were born and raised in northern Colorado. Perhaps other than going to Purdue for your PhD, you returned to northern Colorado, and that's where you reside now. So you've seen that change with respect to drilling in the oil and gas industry there. What other trends or changes might have you witnessed over the years, over the decades, with respect to, say, climate issues or ecosystem changes?
That's a good question. Yes, I did grow up here, and I didn't realize how wonderful the West was. Like many of us, we don't understand what we have till we leave.
Right.
And I ended up in the Midwest and thought to myself, I am heading back to Colorado or Utah as soon as I can. And so I came back, and for sure, when you love something, and then you're more aware of that love, you start to notice the details and you start to protect it. I mean, part of love is wanting to fight and protect and care for that which you love. And as soon as I got back, you know, that was a high building boom. I think at one point about an acre of Colorado ranch lands were being lost about every 10 minutes to a housing development. Mm. And all the ranch lands around my parents' place, north, south, in a larger vicinity, were being developed, and
right.
Field after field I saw pop up other houses. And, you know, that's tricky because I want people to have a place to live, and land use is a very big topic that I'm sure we all know a lot about. But I would just say the flat-out landscape has changed the most.
Right.
When I look out and I'm driving to Denver or something, that tangible, real difference I see.
Right, and we have a growing problem here with the pine beetle, the bark beetle, but there in northern Colorado, I'm sure it seems to be magnitudes larger. Are you witnessing evidence of that in and around you?
Oh, yes. Actually, I just ordered a small table for my home, and it's made out of beetle kilt, which is so gorgeous.
Yes, we've heard about that, that wood has can have a bluish tint to it.
Oh,
that
it's makes so it... pretty, and I'm glad to see it put to use now, but the heartbreak is also there in that, sure, I'm looking up at the mountains right now, and the beetle kill is evident. Also, still the burn scars from the fire are pretty evident, so they look kind of raggedy at the moment. They're not the gorgeous treed foothills and mountains of my youth.
Right. It's not what you came back to or would hope to come back to. And that's the changes that we're seeing. We're seeing changes here. Just this month of November and the first week of December has been unusually warm, relatively dry for the most part. But these are changes that we're witnessing here, not necessarily a year over year or in a linear fashion, but the trends are suggesting that daytime highs are getting a little warmer and nighttime lows are even warmer still, which is really, it's great news if you're a bark beetle.
Right. The bark beetles like that.
Yeah.
And ditto here, of course. It's tough to witness. I try to take a certain amount of appreciative joy and love and curiosity from everything that does go right still year after year. I was just walking, for example, in the mountain mahogany spirals come out this time, or they've been out, but the way they glint in the sun this time of year, I think is just fabulous. Hmm. It's those little details that keep my heart afloat.
That's true.
So tell us about, you know, how you decide what to write about and what other topics you've been drawn to over the past few years.
Well, I consider myself, well, I guess I'm 50-50, but I consider my first energy of a day usually goes into writing fiction. And my four novels that are out and the two that are forthcoming are all set in contemporary Colorado. And I would, you know, I would say that they land and place is very prominent in them. And I'll never be able to write a book that isn't so infused with place because it's just how I see the world and how I want to experience the world. So I'm always writing about place. And then in the afternoons, I turn my attention to nonfiction often for magazine writing or I've worked on a couple anthologies, and I did a book about Colorado's bears. So for me, it's honoring my creative mind that comes first in the morning, and from that comes the imaginative burbling of fiction. And then in the afternoon, my critical brain steps in, and I try to do a little more nonfiction, and teach, and it's a good life. But
right. So, yeah, I'm always curious about the writer's life. I mean, writing for you is a daily activity that is fairly structured.
It is. I will admit freely to being addicted to it. I don't think I process my life very well if I'm not writing.
Right.
And I don't understand what's going on, and I don't know how to live whatever's going on the best way possible unless I'm writing about it. So I'm happily entrenched in that, and it can be tricky to make a living, but magazine writing and teaching has made that possible. Literary fiction is not known for its economic incentive, but my last couple books have done good, and I'm proud of them.
Yeah.
So if you're just joining us, we're speaking with author Laura Pritchett. She's an award-winning author and also a conservationist, and her work is rooted in the American West, and we're talking to her about that work today. Laura, one of the things that you wrote to us is, it's my contention that we're always on the verge of going tame, and it is always the job of artists to untame. So tell us what you meant by that.
Well, that's really been on my mind lately because I've been thinking about the processes of nature and the processes of writing. And so much emphasis is put in our contemporary culture on the end product. And I was introduced to the eco-psychologist Peter Kahn by a wonderful writer named B.K. Lauren. And he talks about rewilding the mind. And lately I've just been, it's just really been on my mind of what he means by that. And what I think he means by that is that, biologists might seek to restore ecosystems by introducing a lost species, such as wolves, to reduce the number of elk or something. Mm-hmm. And rewilding the mind seeks to reintroduce the psyche to choices that aren't limited to the parameters that have been set, that we're all used to, by a culture. And this culture keeps asking us over and over to be tame, you know, to live lives of security and normalcy and material comfort. And that's not all bad, but we certainly prioritize it to the extent that I think we forget how to live a little more wild and think a little more wild. And as an artist, I think that kills you. And so I keep, lately, the last two or three years, I've been trying to put kind of conscious effort and mindfulness into rewilding, what I call rewilding my mind, trying to get it to see beyond what it, you know, the neuron pathways that had been so developed.
So how does this come across then in writing? And how do you work this into your books and your right. short stories?
I'll give two examples, one for fiction and one for non. One was for fiction. My most recent book is told from the point of view of a man with Alzheimer's, and he becomes a poet. For example, he's searching for a slice of tree or a piece of paper, and he can't remember the word for paper, so he calls it a slice of tree, which I think is, you know, it just struck me as a beautiful way to explore language. And so instead of telling the story, you know, from an omniscient narrator or from a caretaker, you know, like a daughter or caretaker, most of the novel or a big hunk of it is told from his point of view. And that, for me, was an active process of asking my brain to speak in a language that was not familiar to me and not mine. And so I spent a lot of time working on that. And I called that rewilding. That is definitely pushing comfortable boundaries of how my mind processes language and so on. And an example of nonfiction, I guess I would say that recently I traveled to New Zealand, or I've gone up on the flights with EcoFlight, in an effort to kind of re-see the world with renewed clarity. I mean, I guess my fear is that I'm getting stale as a human being or as a writer, and as a nature lover, and I just wanted to sometimes travel or for example, flying above Utah and southern Colorado and, you know, so on in a small little Cessna bouncing around, it makes you fall in love with it in a different way and see it in a different way. So I've been trying to do things that you know, maybe physically uncomfortable for me or just difficult logistically, but in order to kind of re-see the West that I love in a new way.
Right, through a different lens, literally, from the window of an airplane. There's a show on the Discovery Channel that actually, it's the show is entirely aerial views of different parts of the world. It's a really fascinating show. All it is just, it's like, today, Italy, and they will just spend an entire half hour flying over Italy, whether it's urban settings, rural settings, different geographic settings, coastal settings, and it does give you a really different view on in the sense how precious things can be, and from 10 or 15,000 feet. So,
I love that. I'll have to check it out.
I think it is on the Discovery. It's one of the few things I watch other than Nell.
C-SPAN 2.
Well, one other thing you mentioned too is that you talked about this briefly about how books sell and that it seems that more and more writers are focus on producing books for sale, right? That's ultimately one of the big goals, for books for sale rather than, let's say, literature with a capital L, as you describe it, that challenges maybe both the writer and the reader to kind of sit down and slowly digest the complexity of a story. Talk a little bit about that, how that challenges you as a writer.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. This is a big shtick of mine, or something I love to talk about, which is, and it's so tied to environmental issues for me, or conservation issues.
Yeah.
Which is, when we sit outside and we watch a rainstorm or a storm or a squirrel or whatever, I think we're watching, and we let ourselves really be mindful of that. We're in the process, of nature, of watching the season unfold or the storm unfold. And with literature, capital L literature, it's also a process. Capital L literature books aren't often easy to read. There's not a tidy ending. They don't usually confirm our cultural expectations. You know, at the end of a romance story, people have fallen in love, and there's true love ever after, and at the end of a Western, justice has been served. But at the end of capital L literature, it's tricky. We're usually presented with big questions about what it is to be a human. And so if you read it, literature, I think you're being mindful of the process of it, and you know, it's not 10 easy steps on how to get rich, or
right.
It's not just about entertainment, or although literature can be entertaining, but it's really about standing in awe of language and humanity, and taking the time to be with that. And I just sometimes I feel discouraged because it's, I don't know, the demise of sales of good, what I consider good, solid literature writing is akin to the glaciers melting or the
right.
beetle kill. It's somehow in my mind they're related.
Right. Well, I mean, Nell and I have learned on this show over the years that environmental issues are very complicated and complex. There's not a simple arc to them because, you know, you're balancing jobs versus protection of the environment versus, like you say, developments and people want to have a quality of life, but that can also require water and fuel and natural resources. And so there's always it's always a complicated dance that goes on.
Yeah.
Between satisfying our quality of life and how we define quality of life and comfort and goals and objectives, and also, you know, taking care of the environment and the concepts of sustainability. It's a complicated issue.
It is, and it sounds like a good book. Complicated capital L.
Chris, you better start writing.
There you go. Laura, you're writing two novels now, you said, in addition to nonfiction?
I am. One's coming out in June. It's called Red Lightning, and it's set on the plains of eastern Colorado. And the one-sentence premise of it is that a Levin Tona, a woman who's been running people across the U.S.-Mexico border, she fails to pick up a group of her people, and they start a signal fire, and that fire becomes the largest fire in Colorado history. And it's burning down everything, and she goes running home as a last-ditch effort to have her sister help her out, and she's got to figure out that she's got to help herself out and that redemption is hard to come by. So I just finished the copy edits to that, and it'll come out from Counterpoint Press in June. And then another book set in the mountains of Colorado comes out the following year.
So wow. So I'm curious, you know, your writing takes on a lot of tough topics, not just environmental ones, but, you know, you talk about Alzheimer's, you talk about immigration, you know, mm-hmm. I guess, in this book. So do you see your writing as a form of advocacy at all, or just an encouragement to kind of think about these issues?
I think that's always a tricky balance with art, and on one side is the Barbara Kingsolver school of thought that often writing is, you know, kind of overtly advocacy, and then social justice or environmental or what have you. And the other end of the spectrum is people who say that ruins art. I tend to land closer to Barbara Kingsolver. I hope my books aren't preachy in any way, but mm-hmm. I do love bringing up very difficult ethical questions and messy topics about assisted suicide and single motherhood and poverty and land use issues. And I like the real, raw, troublesome stuff. It's true.
Sure.
That's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's life, you know?
Yeah.
Well, how do people learn more about you and your books? You have a website.
I do. It's my name, laurapritchett.com. So it's Laura. PRITCHETT.com. And that's probably the best place to start, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It's a great website.
Links to lots of her other writings.
Yes. And your latest novel was Stars Go Blue. And actually, both copies at the library were out. Laura, you go.
That makes me happy, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Laura Pritchett, again, is award-winning author and conservationist. Whose work is rooted in the American West. He's the author of novels Stars Go Blue, Skybridge, and Hell's Bottom, Colorado, which was the winner of the Milkweed National Fiction Prize and the Penn USA Award. Again, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning.
Oh, thanks so much for doing this great show.
All right. Thanks. We'll be in touch.
Thanks.
All right. Let's take a break for a few sponsors. And when we come back, Zach Frankel from Utah Rivers Council joins us. It's This Green Earth.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and have been proud supporters of KPCW since its beginning. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
think Park City's a great place to live? You ought to try meeting here. Recommending Park City for your business, club, or association group is not only a smart idea for them, but it actually helps support the community where you live and play. Meeting and event planning is easy. Log on to parkcitymeetings.com or call 1-800-453-1360. This message brought to you by the Park City Chamber Convention and Visitors Bureau, a nonprofit proud supporter of KPCW programming.
'Twas the month of Christmas, and all through Park City was our support for KPCW and the smell of boughs emanating from Park City Nursery. We've been a tradition since 1983 with Christmas trees, wreaths, and garlands of all sizes. Also offering our wreaths for shipping to family and friends online at parkcitynursery.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's now Larson across the board. And joining us on the phone is Zach Frankel. He is the executive director of Utah Rivers Council. The URC is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the conservation and stewardship of Utah rivers and surrounding ecosystems. And Zach is going to talk a little bit about Utah Rivers Council and some of the work that they're doing, and in particular, why the connection between water and watersheds and the burgeoning fossil fuel industry that's going on and that's happening in the state. Zach, thanks for joining Nell and me this morning.
Good morning, Nell and Chris. It's great to be on your show.
Hey, thanks for joining us. First, give us a little thumbnail sketch of just who Utah Rivers Council is about and when you guys were formed.
Utah Rivers Council is a 501c3 nonprofit organization in Salt Lake City, and we were formed 19 years ago to work on water policy issues, river conservation issues, and sort of the big picture about water problems in Utah.
Wow, 19 years ago. Okay. And how have things changed over those 19 years?
You know, it's interesting. Over those 19 years, the rest of the West has gotten much better about conserving water. Water's becoming more and more of a critical issue that is on people's minds. Of course, it's always been a critical issue, but you know, these days it seems like it's on its ascendancy. More and more people are learning about how important water is. Unfortunately, though, in Utah, not much has changed in 19 years. We still are among... Well, now we're the most wasteful water user per person in the U.S. for municipal water use. We're Utahns are the most wasteful water users for their municipal water in the country. And the rest of the West, now the rest of the country has reduced their water use per person over that time period. So, you know, Utah is dragging behind. We're the sort of the kid that's not so smart when it comes to water policy.
So, Zach, I have to ask, what does that figure include? Does that include the agriculture in Utah? Does that include, you know, only culinary water used at houses? How is that figure of Utah being the most wasteful developed?
I'm glad you asked that, Neil. That's a really important point. So that does not include agriculture. That does not include farming and ranching. Those statistics are from the United States Geological Service, and they are based on what they call domestic withdrawal. So that's municipal and industrial water supplied by public entities. So essentially what that lingo translates into is it's all the water we use in our cities, inside and outside the home, among businesses, inside and outside, and among government institutions, everything from churches and schools to government facilities, government golf courses.
So Hill Air Force Base?
I don't know if Hill Air Force Base is considered an industrial usage. It depends on the what they hang their hat on is whether they are publicly supplied water or whether they are self-supplied. So if a business or any user was to provide their own water to their own uses, that would not be in that total. But in general, that's the minority of water use, water delivery.
So what is our per capita consumption here
so,
in the state?
The state of Utah says our per capita water consumption is 295 gallons per person per day.
What?
That is what they are basing every man, woman, and child's water usage on for the next 60 years. That's what they say we need to provide water for the future.
So let's just round up. 300 gallons per person per day, a family of four, 1,200 gallons a day?
Yeah, it's remarkable. And the national average is 155.
Right.
And now we know that we can't pin it on, agriculture in a dry state or, things along those lines.
And more importantly now, I use like 30 gallons of water a day. So that means somebody out there is making up for my
370 gallons. That's fine. I use 600 a day.
Okay,
so
I thought.
Well, you know, that's people's reaction is to look inward, and they initially, obviously they look at themselves, and sometimes they get defensive, but the real issue here is how we price water and how we encourage people to use water, because Utah has the cheapest water rates in the American West and some of the cheapest water rates in the entire country. And that's why we use so much water. And it seems like a good deal. Who doesn't like a cheap commodity? But the reality, and this is the irony of Utah, we pay property taxes on our homes and businesses, and those property taxes go directly to water districts, water suppliers, to lower the price of water. So even if you are saving water in your house, if you're being really conscientious inside and outside your home, you're still paying these property taxes for your neighbor across the street or that government institution to waste water. And that's our biggest problem, is our cheap water rates, which accrue from our property tax collection.
Right. So again, so I use 30 gallons a day, but I'm still paying in another way for that water through my property taxes.
Exactly.
And therefore, kind of, like you say, subsidizing other people who aren't as water conscious.
That's exactly right. And it's crazy because we don't do that with our other commodities. We don't do that with natural gas or electricity or even our phone service. And you pay for what you use. It's
right.
The cornerstone of free market economics, right? And that's the irony of Utah, is that when you look at the rest of the West, most of the urban water suppliers are not collecting these property taxes. Only Utah does it from border to border in every county in Utah. And, of course, that raises the obvious question, why? Why do we encourage people in the second driest state to waste water by collecting property taxes?
Mm. So that kind of leads into what I was just going to ask you. We have this incredibly high water use. What is, the future of our water use look like in Utah? Mm-hmm. Are there, is there any move to decrease this? Is there enough? How does that, impact our plans?
That's an excellent question. We're kind of at the crossroads right now for our future. On the one path is conservation, smartening up, and following the lead of other Western communities that are saying we need to conserve water. And if we go down that path, we don't have to dry up our rivers. We don't have to impact ecosystems that depend on our rivers. And we don't have to indebt ourselves with billions and billions of dollars in new spending. On the other path is what the water suppliers are proposing, what they want, the folks that sell us water. They want to keep collecting these property taxes, and they want to be paid billions and billions of dollars in new taxes and debt to build very big water projects. In fact, the biggest water projects proposed in the United States right now are in Utah. The Lake Powell Pipeline is a $2 billion proposed water project out of the Colorado to get water to St. George, Utah. And the Bear River Development is a water project proposed that would divert the single largest source of water, the Great Salt Lake, every year. And in doing so, would lower the Great Salt Lake several feet in elevation and dry up tens of thousands of acres of shoreline wetlands. So that's a $2.4 billion project. So all of these projects are going to come with debt, and their water suppliers are telling us that they're essential to our future, that we're going to dry up. In reality, that's not really the case. Even if we didn't build those projects, we wouldn't really run out of water. Because 85% of the water used in Utah is for agriculture.
Okay. So does there need to be changes in agricultural consumption of water?
Well, you know, we could certainly save water on the farm through efficiency standards and retain our farmlands. That's the best thing we could do, is keep our farmlands and modernize the water delivery system. Of course, the problem, of course, is that farmers and ranchers are land rich and cash poor, and so they don't really have the capital to spend a lot of money to make their water delivery systems more efficient. But it's certainly, you're certainly right, Chris, that's a huge potential source of money to keep those farms in operation, but make them more efficient and save the water for other uses.
Right, okay. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Zach Frankel. He's the executive director of Utah Rivers Council. And Zach, let's talk a little bit about the recent joining of groups here at an alliance to form another alliance called the Colorado River Connection. The URC has joined together with Colorado River Keeper, Sierra Club, Utah Physicians for Healthy Environment to form this alliance. What is the intent of this new alliance?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting and exciting coalition. So, you know, we as Utahns, we think kind of an island mentality about Utah because, you know, we live up here in the mountains. And we forget often that our state is the source of Colorado River water for millions of people, tens of millions of people downstream. Mm-hmm. And yet 80% of the flows of the Colorado River come from the three headwater states, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. And so the project is to go down to lower basin residents and tell them about the many threats posed in Utah. So I mentioned the water diversions, the Lake Powell pipeline is the largest proposed diversion of Colorado River water, which will have major impacts on cities downstream. But there's also a lot of energy, as you sort of alluded to earlier, a lot of dirty energy, in fact, being proposed in Utah. You know, in the last 10 years, Utah's doubled the stock of oil and gas wells in our boundaries here in Utah. And the proposed tar sands and oil shale, in addition to the fracking activities, are very destructive on our watersheds. They pollute our aquifers, and they stand to really impact residents downstream. So this coalition has been formed by Waterkeeper and Utah Rivers Council and Sierra Club and also Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment and Living Rivers down in Moab to reach out and to try and start telling these watershed stories. It's not much different than the watershed stories of talking to local residents here, you know, in Park City or down in the Salt Lake Valley about where their water comes from. It's the same concept. It's just going further down into the watershed of the lower Colorado River Basin to do the same.
Right. And in your newsletter, you mentioned some of the numbers here. 640 oil and gas wells proposed along the Strawberry River alone, and 5,000 oil and gas wells proposed adjacent to Desolation Canyon.
Yeah.
That's basically one well a day for the next 16 years. That's what we're talking.
That's really well said, you know, and the impacts of that, you know, we want some balance. It's not that we're opposed to energy development in Utah, but we need some balance, and we're not having the monitoring and the protection of our watersheds that we need. You know, we've seen oil spills into the Green River, into the San Juan River, into the Escalante River. We've seen these spills contaminating our watersheds, and the state just kind of shrugs and moves on, with tepid fines, if any, imposed at all. And so we're really, really concerned about what it's going to do if we double again our stock of standing wells. You know, Utah's now the 10th largest producer of oil and gas in the country.
Right.
And the question, you know, that Utahns need to be asking themselves is, you know, what kind of balance do they strive for between the recreational economy and the energy economy? You know, where is the protection that we need? We have the least amount of protected watershed lands in the western U.S. through wilderness protection, even though we have some of the most majestic landscapes in the American West. So, you know, we need better balance to embrace the 21st century. And we're really concerned about Utah's impacts upon the watershed and the residents downstream.
So one thing that we want to touch base with you on is in-stream flow. And there's this lack of protection for in-stream flow, or as Chris put it before the show, Utah's rivers have no legal right to exist.
That's amazing.
And I liked that wording. So is the new Colorado River Connected working on this issue? Is Utah River Councils working on this? And where does that stand?
That's an excellent question. So you're totally right. You know, it's really silly that the Utah legislature does not recognize rivers as having a right to exist. They're just water rights on their way downstream to some user. And that's crazy. What we need is a viable in-stream flow law. We have an in-stream flow lease where we can establish flows for a short term, but they are very restrictive. They're not allowed to protect the river's flows for all of the species inhabitants. They only are for native trout. So that was a way to prevent water rights from being transferred into the stream. So Colorado River Connected is not working on that right now. What we need to address that issue is new legislation in the legislature. And Utah Rivers Council, we started working on in-stream flow laws, back 15 years ago, putting together a committee and drafting legislation. What ended up resulting out of that committee was this current in-stream flow lease, which is really inadequate. And what's really needed is to amend it. Whether or not that's going to happen this session seems unlikely, but we hope in a future legislative session that we can get a bill passed. But the problem is our legislature is got some great people in it, and it's got some people that aren't quite so receptive to in-stream flows and conservation values. I know that's not exactly news. But what we really need is to get legislators to understand that balance in our river ecosystems, that making sure we have water in the stream, is in everyone's best interest.
Right, including the fish. So fish and frogs come last. In the order of rights. Is that unique to the state of Utah, or does Nevada, Idaho, Arizona,
Colorado,
do they have similar patterns?
So in-stream flows are definitely, as you're alluding to, are driven by the state legislatures. And, you know, really the short answer is it depends. Some states like Montana and Idaho are more receptive to in-stream flows. Montana has a good in-stream flow law. And the way to think about in-stream flows is actually with a free market, because we could, if we had a good in-stream flow law, we could easily increase the amount of water that's in our streams. And in fact, many landowners, you know, they conserve their land through open space. They, farmers and ranchers and other landowners, want to see their lands continue in their open capacity. And oftentimes they want to see the water of the streams that are crossing their lands. They also want to see those put in in-stream flows. But the state legislature won't let them. So, you know, in other words, there's a market that exists to bring the buyer and the seller together, the landowner with water rights who wants to make sure that water stays in the stream, and conservation buyers that want to protect those flows for trout, for ecosystems, for whatever purposes, just to have a river exist. And the legislature is standing in between the buyer and the seller and preventing it from happening.
So
whether we're able to do that, to get legislators to step out of that transaction and let the market regulate itself, that's really the key to our future. And other states have done a better job of it, but not every state has great in-stream flow laws. Nevada doesn't have a very good in-stream flow law either.
Okay. Well, we got a few minutes, and I wanted to go back to this issues with respect to watersheds and the energy extraction industry, because, you know, you talk about obviously the potential impacts of spills or leaks or other disasters that could pollute rivers and streams and groundwater, et cetera. But I think the listeners need to know that these industries, whether it's tar sands or oil, or oil shale or fracking, they're very water intensive. businesses too. So they will have the potential to remove a lot of water out of watersheds just to make their industry go.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you circled back around to that, because that's something folks don't understand. Unlike traditional oil and gas development, which don't have to use a lot of water, although fracking definitely is a one-time use of the deep water aquifers by polluting them.
Right.
Tar sands and oil shale are really unique, and we should probably just really quickly address what they are. So the concept of both tar sands and oil shale is to take the oil that's impregnated into the rock and sand and grind it up in a new process to basically melt the oil out of it, to try and get the oil out of it. It's very energy intensive, mm-hmm. first of all, and as you mentioned, it requires an extremely large amount of water. It is a strip mining operation, so it's more similar to mountaintop removal. It's about denuding vast tracts of land of any vegetation. And then we're told that there's this citrus compound that's totally innocuous, that's just oranges. But in practice, the pilot project for this stuff. Yeah, right. If only, right? You can make smoothies out of it when you're done.
Unfortunately, it's 4 million oranges.
If you've got a little leftover, just sip that on your way home.
Right. Yeah. But it requires vast amounts of water.
Yeah.
And if the tar sands and oil shales leases, if they're approved on public lands as large as is being discussed, we could see, you know, 1 million acre feet of water used for these extract proposals, and it would have, you know, it would be a one-time use of watershed lands. I mean, at least oil and gas, at least you can still allow some habitat to remain when the area is properly reclaimed at the end of the project cycle. But tar sands and oil shale, that won't happen. It'll just be a one-time use, and then we'll be stuck with what could be Superfund sites one day.
Right, because that's, particularly in, with respect to the oil shale, this retorting of kerogen impregnated rock, it's not even oil. It's not even crude. It's kerogen, which is a precursor to oil. It's like baby oil, as I call it. And then they're going to cook it, like you described, Zach, in a clay-lined earthen oven. Imagine the largest tandoori oven on the planet. And they're going to cook that at roughly 700 degrees for almost 3 months. And then there will be a oil-like substance that comes out that will be extracted out of that, and then off to the refineries. The energy required to run an oven at 700 degrees, and this is acres in size. These are ovens that are acres in size, is mm-hmm. astounding. So mm-hmm. that's the thing that's coming, and that's the stuff that you're working on.
And that's what you've done an excellent job of you've done your homework, and you've done an excellent job of articulating it all. And I think you it's exactly as you describe, and that raises the concern about whether it's going to be sustainable or not. Yeah. What we could see is an initial infusion of capital, all these lands used to do this ridiculous proposal you just described, and then these guys just cut bait and run away, and we're stuck cleaning up with the mess, and it could be massive in scope. Unfortunately, the state of Utah is permitting this, and they're not really giving careful, adequate consideration to this. They're basically just cheerleaders of this proposed technology, yeah. And they're not worried about the groundwater impacts, and it's crazy. It's crazy to embark upon this. One time, we're basically blowing the inheritance that a previous generation gave us on these public lands. Mm. And what are we doing with it? We're gonna get this. I hesitate to even call it oil, because as you just described, it's not oil.
No.
It's immature hydrocarbons out of the rock and sand.
So are there any specific projects that are kind of on the docket right now that people should be aware of, that they could comment on, that they could get involved in?
So the one I would definitely talk about, if you're talking about any in Utah, the Lake Powell pipeline is the most mature. And the state of Utah spent $25 million on that environmental impact statement to date. And it is going to be proposed for application in this coming spring of 2015. So that's the one that's the most mature. That one's actually in real permitting, and it would have big impacts both on Utah's pocketbooks and on the water supply of the Colorado River immediately upstream of the Grand Canyon. So that's one of the ones that's certainly the most mature. That's one we're really concerned about. For the energy, Monument Butte oil proposal is really a scary one. Chris mentioned that 5,400 wells proposed as part of that project. And that one that would literally a 50% increase in the standing stock of oil and gas wells in Utah. Very concerning. So those two are coming up both in 2015, and we'll be reaching out to folks and the public and asking them to get involved in that. Those would be the two biggest ones, I would say.
All right, Zach, we've got to wrap up. Websites for your organization and others you might be interested in us to visit?
Yeah, so our organization's website is just utahriverscouncil.org. Really easy to find. You just Google Utah Rivers Council. We have all kinds of technical reports and information. So we have short videos to watch on our website. And then the coalition is Colorado River Connected. And if you just Google that, you'll find it, but it's coloradoriverconnected.org. And we're still authoring content alongside all of our partners. And we have three pillars there of dirty energy, water diversions, and climate change. And folks can visit both websites and get educated about these issues. And we'd love to get people involved if they were interested in volunteering in any other capacity.
All right, Zach Frankel again. He's the executive director of Utah Rivers Council. And Zach, as always, it's a pleasure to chat with you. And we will definitely be in touch to get more updates on these pipelines.
Sounds great, Chris and Nell. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take one last break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, it's time to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, I'm Maren Mullen, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that water conservation is what we're really all about, and you thought it was only recycling? We save your H2O. How? By encouraging you to recycle more, by teaching our students how to conserve water, and by making it possible for you to drop off hazardous waste at our collection events. Yep, we're all about saving your water, because we can't live without it. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization bringing conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, wattsmart.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
All right, welcome back to This Green Earth. We are here to wrap up today's show, and we want to tell you who our guests are going to be next week.
Yeah, couple things. Dan Fagan is the author of a book called Tom's River. It's a great story, Pulitzer Prize-winning story, about a town in New Jersey that was looking for a growth in its economy, and along came Siba Geigy, the international chemical industry, and things happen from there. So we'll be talking to him. Also, we're going to be talking to Breathe Utah, representative from Breathe Utah, about the governor's proposal to ban wood-burning fireplaces from November through March. Okay, and what does that mean to us here in Summit County? Well, actually, it may not mean, because we may be exempt from that. And restaurants too. So we'll find more. You will find more about that when we speak to Breathe Utah next week. Let's do our underwriters and sponsors.
That's right. Thanks to Recycle Utah.
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
San Francisco Design,
and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services.
Of course, you can join us on Facebook and like us there and send us your comments, KPCW, This Green Earth.
You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.